Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. This is Ray Bohax, your host, the Hot Rod Farmer. I'm hoping that the sound of my voice finds you doing well today, and you have to excuse me because I have sinus issues and my throat is a little bit congested. So if I have to clear my throat every once in a while, I ask in advance for your forgiveness. So we're just about getting ready to start to harvest our sweet corn. As I said in the podcast a week or two ago, we were getting ready to do that. And when you, by the time you listen to this, we will really be deep into the harvest. And it's just been a very, very digital year. It was wet this spring. It wasn't excessively wet. It was just too wet to get into the field, if that makes any sense. And we basically didn't have a lot of snow over the winter. We had a couple of big dumps, but they were not, didn't have a lot of moisture content in them. So we were really low on the water table, which is seems to be an occurrence the past number of years. But anyway, we were damp in the spring. It was a little bit too damp to get in the field. So I got in later than I had hoped to. And then we had no rain. And then it got very, very hot. We had about a week or 10 days of 100-degree weather. And then we got about 8 inches of rain in a week, which was fine because we needed it. But then the sun never came out. So my corn doesn't really know what to do. It's been on, off, dry, drought stressed. I don't want to say flooded, extremely wet. But right now it's just something where I think the plant is going crazy. So I just don't think that it really knew what to do. We do 10 plantings, and my first planting I am kind of disappointed in, and that's the one that saw the extreme weather conditions and also was some leftover seed from last year. And historically, that's not a problem. We freeze the seed, and then I do a germination test, and I usually have about 90% germination, which is just about what you would get with new seed. But whatever the good Lord has for us, we'll be happy to take. And the other plantings do look very well, thank God. So that's a good consolation. So the first planting is not what I'd hoped it to be, and it's farming is like the Indy 500, right? It's not over till the last lap. And that first planting really looked great, and it really endured the drought stress of the extremely dry weather and the heat. And it just after that, it never seemed to take off the way it should have. I don't know whether it sapped all the energy out of it, or to tell you the truth, I mean, I think it was probably a combination of things, and I think it was more the cloudy days. I mean, we really had no sun this year whatsoever. After that hot weather spell, it's been very, very overcast and cloudy and actually gloomy. But, hey, that's farming, right? So hopefully things are better on your place as you get ready to go into harvest. And God willing, you'll have a bountiful crop. And what I wanted to talk about today in the podcast is that so many people, when they look to buy parts for their equipment, think that parts are parts. And they think that no matter what brand you buy or where you source it from, that if it looks the same, that it is the same, and the factory is just really trying to steal your money by charging you more for a part. So we're going to address that today. I know that may be a sensitive subject for some of you, but you know, that's what this podcast is about. It's about telling you the truth, not what you want to hear. I think too many times in life today, people just are told what they want to hear, and that does no one any good to tell you what you want to hear. We need to tell you what you need to know. And as a professional, I mean, if you go to a doctor, you want him to tell you the truth so you could be cured. You don't want him to tell you what you want to hear. So I'm going to tell you what you don't want to hear. I'm going to talk about some parts, but I'd like to start again with a little story. And back in 2015, so that's 3 years now, my wife Charlotte and I decided to go out to St. John's, Michigan, and visit with AgroLiquid at the AgroLiquid fertilizers. At the time, they were called Agriculture Liquid Fertilizers, and I wanted to go up to their facility. I had seen their ads on television, and I was very intrigued by the fact that they said that you could, if your soil is not nutrient deficient, that you could put all your nutrient needs on through the sprayer. So I was very interested in that, and I really didn't understand the concept of their product. And I wanted to go out there and see what it was all about, because to me, fertilizer was fertilizer. I mean, I obviously know there's different types of fertilizer, but I looked at fertilizer as I did windshield washer fluid. And, you know, it made no difference what brand it was, that the windshield washer fluid was more or less the same. And I would go to the store and I would buy whatever was on sale, and I would use that, and I'd be happy as a lark, and I'd, you know, be pretty proud of myself. Oh, I saved a little bit of money on this windshield washer fluid. And sadly, I looked at fertilizer through the same set of eyes. I really didn't think there was much difference in the quality of fertilizers, and I didn't think that there was much technology difference, and I just thought that, you know, N, P, and K, and micronutrients, and wherever they were sourced from, it was kind of moot. It didn't really make much of a difference. And, you know, farming in New Jersey has its own obstacles. I guess it has its own advantages, and they are few, but it has a lot of obstacles, and the obstacles are the main obstacle that we face about farming in New Jersey is that we do not have the outlets to purchase crop protection products and fertilizers from a whole bunch of different organizations. In our neck of the woods, we have a GrowMark FS dealer, and that's really basically it. So you either get everything you need from him, or you have to go out of state, go to Pennsylvania or New York State or down to Delaware. Not so much Delaware from me, because I'm in North Jersey, so you need to go out to Pennsylvania or upstate New York, New York State, we would say. We call it New York State because in this neck of the woods, if you say New York, people think it's New York City. So, in essence, whatever GrowMark FS sold, that's what you ended up using, unless you wanted to put some wheels underneath it and get out there and look for a different brand or a different product. And since most people didn't think of fertilizer or chemicals being much different in nature, they would just do business locally. And I have no issue with that, and I like to support my local businesses. But I know as an engine guy and also as a farmer that I want to have a selection. I want to be able to select the components that I use on my farm, the chemicals and the fertilizers. And I was a little bit frustrated by having only one source and one brand to deal with. So anyway, so what happened was that I was really intrigued by AgroLiquid's ads, and their ads in the magazine and on television and on the radio. So I decided to go up there with my wife, and also they have at their facility, I had found, they have a building called the IQ Hub, which is I subsequently found that when I got there, which is really wonderful. If you're ever in St. John's, Michigan area, the IQ Hub is a must-see if you're ever in Michigan, and it's an educational learning facility about, it's self-guided, and it's about the history of fertility, and you really have to go there to see it. It's very hard to explain. It's exquisitely done, and it's definitely a destination for anybody who's in agriculture. And it has really, even though it's in AgroLiquid's facility, it really has nothing much to do with them. They talk about fertility and about how fertility came about, understanding how a plant consumes fertility and needs fertility. Just really an excellent, excellent experience. And I think no matter how knowledgeable you are as a farmer, or even an agronomist, I'm sure that you could go to the IQ Hub at the AgroLipid facility and come away learning something, feeling it was a worthwhile visit. Well, anyway, so we got in the car, we went up to Michigan, and we toured the facility, and they also took us to the test farm. They have about a 1,000-acre test farm, and I came away from that experience, and I got in the car, and I said, turned to my wife and said, we have to, you know, employ this technology next year in our farm, that I did not understand prior to going there what a high efficiency fertilizer was, or what low salt fertilizer was, or I really knew nothing about fertilizer other than it was vitamins for the crop. And after leaving there, even though I was certainly no agronomist, but I saw enough and learned enough while at my stay there, at my visit, to be able to say that we need to use this on our farm, and that's it. I mean, I'm not going to be a chemist. I don't want to be a chemist, but we need to use it. So subsequently, in 2016, we were going to buy some new equipment. Bought a new planter, and since I decided to go with the AgroLiquid program, I had the planter built to have liquid fertilizer instead of dry fertilizer. And subsequently, we did the program for the first time in 2016. We had spectacular results. But the reason why I'm telling you this is because just as I thought that fertilizer is fertilizer, that most people think that parts are parts, which I said in the beginning. And I wanted to explain to you why you should buy original equipment parts when they are available. Now, I know I probably got somebody's dandruff right away because you think that you know, I'm trying to spend your money unnecessarily to go to the dealer and buy a replacement part from them, whether it's for a piece of farm equipment or even for a vehicle. But I'm going to explain to you why. And hopefully at the end of this podcast, you'll be able to find value in what I am telling you. A good friend of mine, Bob Ida, has a saying, and it's very simple, and you could move it around, and you could change it around to whatever you want it to be to fit it. It's not engraved in stone. And the way he says it is that I am not wealthy enough to be able to afford to buy something that cheap. At first blush, that seems like a contradiction. But if you listen to what he's saying, what he's conveying is that he's not affluent enough to be able to buy something two or three times because it's junk or it's of poor quality or if it doesn't perform the way you want it to perform. So he's saying that I need to be able to buy something once and buy it right. And that really is very important when it comes to buy parts for your equipment. So the thing is that why do I suggest buying, and I follow my own medicine, I buy nothing but factory parts for my cars, my trucks, and my farm equipment. I paid a couple of dollars more, but I want the factory part. And the reason being is that when the aftermarket makes a part, and this is not a knock on the aftermarket, there are times when you have to buy an aftermarket part for an older piece of equipment that's no longer serviced by the original manufacturer or an older engine or what have you. But when the aftermarket makes a part, they are trying to reverse engineer the factory part, but also they need to be able to bring this part in at a cost that will make it desirable for the consumer to purchase. So let's give a random example. Let's say that your tractor needs a water pump. And if you went to the dealer, whatever brand it is, and you went to the dealer and they said, okay, a water pump, a new water pump is $400. And then you went to an aftermarket source and they said, well, you know, a new water pump from us is $200. So you're saying, well, why should I pay $400 for a water pump when I could get one for $200? Well, the thing is that it's everything that you cannot see. is what makes that pump much more money than the aftermarket. So what the aftermarket has to do is they have to compromise the design, they have to compromise the materials, and they have to compromise the whole package to try to make it fit many applications so that they could amortize the cost and get the cost down. And that is one of the keys to why there is a big price differential. Now I'm going to have, for full disclosure, I'm not going to deny that maybe the dealer has a higher markup level on it or what have you, but we're talking about the quality of the part. So for instance, let's talk about, and I'll make an automotive analogy because it's something everyone can connect with. So let's say your pickup truck needs brakes, and we'll say it's a Ford pickup truck, and it needs brakes, this first brake job. So that means right now it has on it factory brake pads and factory brake rotors. What a lot of people do not understand is that when it comes to friction material, and this pertains to brake pads and it also pertains to clutches and to drum brakes, drum shoes, and brake drums, is that there is a synergy, that there is a recipe that needs to be met between the friction material and the friction surface. And this synergy is going to result in the way that, for instance, the braking system functions. Now, it's going to function with an aftermarket brake rotor on it. I'm not going to deny that. But all the intangibles, so in other words, the feel of the brake pedal, the stopping distance, the noise level, the amount of dust, and the wear characteristics are all dependent upon the synergy between the friction material and the friction surface. Now, for instance, if you were to look at most OE applications, most original equipment applications, right, and I believe that using Ford as an example, because I had the data, is that from the factory, they have about 35 different metallurgical formulas for brake rotors and about 75 or 80 different formulas for brake pad composition. And the reason why they go through all of that is that you need to have that synergy for this vehicle to stop properly, give a long service life, for the braking action to be smooth, for it to be controllable, and all of the attributes that you would look at for proper brake performance. The aftermarket has, and this is a known fact, the aftermarket, for most part, the better aftermarket brands have about 3 different formulas for friction material, that's the brake pad, and 1 or 2 formulas, if even that, for the friction surface, which is the metallurgy of the brake rotor. And if you go to the cheapest aftermarket stuff, right, what you're going to find is that they have one formula for all the brake friction material brake pads, and they have one formula for the metallurgy, and all they basically do is have that part fit. So they'll cut that pad differently, or that pad will be shaped differently, or that rotor will be shaped differently in a different mold, a different casting for that particular application. But basically, it's the same friction material, and it's the same friction surface. And that really is an issue. And if you ever GM used to have, General Motors used to have, back in the 70s, they had an ad campaign that said, you know, keep that great GM feeling. And this is one of the things they were talking about, is that the aftermarket does not have the ability to design and manufacture everything to the level that the OE does, because the OE is making it application specific, whereas the aftermarket, to come into the price point that the consumer will embrace versus the factory part, they have to be able to just make one size fits all, in essence. And that is a very common thing where you would change the brakes on brake pads and the rotors, and you put, or you'd have keep the factory rotors and put aftermarket pads, and the vehicle stops, or the clutch works. The same thing happens with clutch discs and pressure plates. The clutch works, but it, you know, it doesn't feel the same as it used to, and it may not, you know, it may not last as long, or with brakes it may a little bit more noise, and they may squeal, or they may have brake dust, or they may not, or they may hold some water when it's wet or what have you. But I mean, will the vehicle stop? Yes. Will the clutch work? Yes. I'm not going to say it doesn't, but it doesn't feel the same as new, and most people attribute that to it, the vehicle or the machine getting older, when it really is a mismatch of the surfaces for the friction surface and the friction material. But you know, that's not the end of the world. If you're willing to live with that and you want to save, you know, $20 or $30 on a set of brake pads and or set of rotors or a clutch disc or a pressure plate, well, that's your decision. To me, I don't think that that's a smart decision, because I don't like to do the job twice. And when you use aftermarket parts, to a certain extent, you will most likely have more wear and not have the life cycle that the factory part would, and you would also not have the performance. But where it really comes to play is with modern engines and modern equipment with electronics. And many modern engines use what is called a mass airflow sensor. And if you look, go to the website, my website, farmmachinerydigest.com, I actually have a lecture hall series, a little voice of audio on how to properly clean a mass airflow sensor. But on most engines today, they'll use a mass airflow sensor on most gasoline engines, and on most light-duty diesel engines that you have in pickup trucks, that they'll use a mass airflow sensor. And what the mass airflow sensor, say that 10 times quickly, what that basically does is measures the amount of air that's coming into the engine, and it uses that, the computer, the ECU, uses that as a load calculation to determine the ignition timing on the gas engine and the fuel events, the fueling through the fuel injectors. And on the diesel, it basically does the same thing, but instead of ignition timing, it uses that as one of the main decision-making facts in the injector pulse width and the timing of the injector opening. And if you look at most aftermarket or rebuilt mass airflow sensors, and there is a table that's called a transfer table. You're not going to be able to see this. And what it basically does is a transfer table is identifies at what output on that mass airflow sensor, and they could either be a frequency, which is a square wave, or it could be an analog sensor, which is a varying voltage. Most of them today are a frequency, but the transfer table identifies at what airflow into the engine, what load that each frequency or each voltage identifies. And what you'll find is that with an aftermarket component is that that is not aligned with the transfer table that the manufacturer originally wrote in the ECU, the calibration software. So what's happening is, yes, let's say the sensor failed and it has a service engine soon light and the vehicle is not running properly, and it gets diagnosed as a mass airflow sensor. You look at a factory piece, it's $500. You look at an aftermarket piece from the auto parts store in town, and it's $90. You say, man, I'm going for the $90 one. I'm not going for the $500 one. And you're saving $400 in parts of parts. It looks the same, and you're happy as a lark because it bolts on the same, and it looks all good, and you start up the engine, and yeah, it runs, the check engine light, the service engine soon light's no longer on, but it really doesn't run the way it used to. And that's simply because that sensor doesn't have the degree of resolution that the factory sensor did, and it's also skewing, whereas it's sloppy. Its signal is very sloppy, and the ECU cannot use that for as accurate data, and now your fueling and your ignition timing curve is all off. And I've seen many instances, especially with something which people think is as simplistic as an oxygen sensor, is that they've replaced the oxygen sensor with an aftermarket brand, and the vehicle did not run right. The engine had a whole multitude of drivability problems, and a lot of additional money was spent, and simply because the output of that sensor was not proper for that application. So to bring this around full circle, is that just like I was ignorant to fertilizer, and I didn't understand, you know, what high efficiency fertilizer was, I didn't understand what low salt fertilizer was, I just thought fertilizer was fertilizer, that most people, when it comes time to buy parts, that they look and they price shop them. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with price shopping, but it's only relevant if you are getting the same quality. Now, something as simple as a water pump. How many people have a water pump fail on an engine, and they go and they put an aftermarket water pump on, and the casting looks the same, the bolt holes are in the same place, the gasket fits, everything, it bolts right up with no problems, and then afterwards, the engine under certain conditions seems to be running hotter than it did before. And as I said a few minutes ago, sadly what happens is that since these parts fail when the machine gets older or the engine gets older, is that you tend to think that it's like, well, it's getting tired and that's why it's doing this, or that's why it's running hotter or what have you. But when you look at the water pump, that the whole key to the water pump is the impeller design. And when you buy, in most instances, when you choose an aftermarket water pump, is that the impeller design may not be the same as the factory one. Whereas the factory one may have been cast, the impeller is stamped, and then what they do is that to make the stamping, they bend the tangs of the impeller over and they make the impeller vanes differently, and it doesn't flow the same amount of coolant through the engine. Does it pump coolant? Yes. But now you have an engine that's running hotter under load than you had before the pump failed. Before you only had a leaky water pump through the seal, if the engine did not run hot, but you put this new water pump in and now it's running hotter. It's not overheating, but it's running hotter. Now keep in mind also is that, using a pickup truck for an example, that even if that engine, that same engine family, is used in a car and used in a truck, in most instances, the pickup truck has a different water pump design than the same engine in the car. And that has to do with the flow rate of the water pump and also the pulley ratio. Most water pumps are designed to spin just about 1.7 times the speed of the crank pulley. So just under 2 times the crankshaft pulley speed. And on a heavy-duty application, they may have that pump designed to spin at maybe 1.9 times the crankshaft speed or 2 times the crankshaft speed. And also, for instance, on a heavier duty, like a pickup truck application, where they feel that truck is going to be loaded and that engine is going to be working much more than it would in a passenger car, that they'll have a different impeller, and they may also have a different passage in the housing. The housing exterior would look the same, but the passage internally would be different, and it may be larger to increase the flow, or they may have a flow director in it, or what have you. And you know, all of this is application specific. I'm just throwing things out to you so that you could understand that there is a reason why it's different. And that's why when you were to go, using the same example, that if you were to go to the dealer and get a water pump, using an example, and it would be a different part number than that same engine in the car. When you go to the aftermarket, it's the same part number. And, you know, that's something you could even see with the internet today. So if you don't want to believe me, do a search, go onto one of these websites, and, for instance, you know, take a 4.6 liter in a Ford pickup truck, in an older Ford pickup truck, and a 4.6 liter V8 in a Crown Victoria or Mercury Grand Marquis, using that as an example. Or if you're a General Motors guy, you know, use the equivalent car and that truck engine, and then go into the aftermarket and look up a water pump and online for one of the aftermarket houses, and you'll get a part number, and then probably, I'd say there's an 85 to 90% chance that they would give you that same part number for the truck application. But then if you go to the manufacturer's website, most of these companies are Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, have websites that allow you to look up OE factory part numbers, and you'll see that the part number is different. And that is because there are elements of that water pump that are critical to the use of it being in a truck application versus in a passenger car that's loafing down the road. So there are differences, just like there are differences in fertilizer, that there are differences in parts. And I don't like doing a job twice, and I feel that if I'm purchasing something that's not a consumable, it's going to have a long life, whether it's brake pads, whether it's brake pads, bearings, what have you, water pump. I want to spend the extra money and get the factory part and have the quality and know that that part is designed exactly for that application, and the few dollars that I spent more in the scheme of life is going to mean nothing. But all you have to do is allow that to bite you one time, and all your profit, or your savings, I should say, not profit, from buying something that was a little bit cheaper over the years gets evaporated very, 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 very quickly. So look at it that way. Now, like I say, in some instances, you have to buy an aftermarket part because the factory part is no longer available, or there may be instances where you need to get this vehicle or this piece of equipment up and running, and it's going to take a week to get the factory part, and you have to buy an aftermarket part. Then I would say at that particular point, you'll stick with a name brand aftermarket supply company. I mean, not so much the store, but the supplier. So if you're going to buy a water pump, see if you get a TRW water pump. See if you get a Federal Mogul water pump instead of one from China in some a Joe's water pump company that is coming in at a much lower price point. Because if you were to get a very high quality name brand aftermarket part that in many times is also a tiered supplier to the OE. In the automotive industry and in the equipment industry, they have what they call tier 1, tier 2, tier 3 suppliers. And a tier 1 supplier is somebody that supports the manufacturer directly. So if John Deere is building an engine and they need pistons and they go to TRW to make the piston, that's considered a tier 1 supplier. That piston is made exactly to John Deere specification, but it's made in a TRW factory. And then they have tier 2, tier 3, and usually tier 2 and tier 3 are value added parts, so they may have something that's like an alternator, and one company could be a tier 3 supplier. So in other words, they're making only the bearing that's going in the alternator, but they're not actually making the entire alternator. But if you stick with a major name brand company, you'll most likely be dealing with a tier 1 supplier, and that's your best bet if you cannot get the factory part. But like Bobby Ida says, hey, I'm not rich enough to be able to afford to buy something that cheap. And that's how I look at it. And I also look at anything on the farm, any equipment on the farm. I look at a fire engine or an ambulance or a police car. To me, that's akin to an emergency vehicle. As we all know, agriculture is a very time-sensitive business, and we cannot afford delays, we cannot afford failures, and we need to be able to get in the field and need to do what we have to do. And we have to rely on that equipment, and the equipment is only as good as the parts and components that you put in it. So it is really a smart business move that when possible and when available to use the factory parts and to spend a couple extra dollars and to be able to go into the field in confidence. So like I said, most people don't like hearing this. They think that it's a bunch of malarkey, just like I thought fertilizer was fertilizer. But to put closure to that, that fertilizer story is that we were blessed in 2016. I bought the new planter, and had that custom built. If you go onto the website, there's a picture of it up there. But anyway, custom built planter, 28-inch rows. It's I call it my hot rod planter because it's based on John Deere Max Emerge units, but it has Keaton seed firmers, precision planting meters, Shoup no-till coulters, Copperhead Ag Furrow Cruiser closing wheels, and I think double disc openers for liquid fertilizer. It's 2x2 and something else on it, but I forgot what right now. But anyway, I call it my hot rod planter. But we, in 2016, we were blessed to be able to invest in the planter, and I also bought an Underfirth Perfecta 12 field cultivator and a brilliant subsoiler. But what happened is that we went with the complete agro liquid program, and I did a broadcast of some of their products. But the thing that really I wanted to talk about was that in my 2x2, based upon my soil test, they actually made a blend for me that was 11 different of their products in a 2x2, and that 2016 was a very, very dry year here, and I had a beautiful crop. I was blessed with a beautiful and a bountiful crop, and I attribute that to the high-efficiency fertilizer and my crop not wasting water looking for nutrients, that the nutrients are readily available. So not only the main nutrients, but the micronutrients readily available. And I was really, really impressed with the performance of that product. And it gets back to, like I said, I saw the analogy of buying a factory part and buying a quality part, or buying a quality fertilizer, and just having the performance. And that's really what it's all about, whether it's performance in the field for nutrients, performance in the field for fungicide or a hybrid, or performance as far as your equipment is concerned, is that we need to have performance because we can't afford, we're not rich enough to be able to buy something that cheap. So what I would like to do now is stop beating you with that, and I'd like to go to our special delivery section. And I had a gentleman contact me, Kenny, and he has a Massey 213S. And I looked that up because I wasn't familiar with it, and it's a little compact tractor. And he wrote to me, and he says, "My tractor started missing after running a bush hog for 30 minutes. I recently changed the fuel filter. I used a Wix." Okay, nothing against Wix. I looked, but there are no leaks. Any suggestions? Well, he doesn't give us a lot of information here, but what I'm assuming is that he was bush hogging for 30 minutes, and then I'm assuming he shut the tractor off, or maybe he got done bush hogging. I really don't know. And I don't know what the time frame was between when it started to misfire and when it ran fine. So from his letter, it appears that he shut it off, and when he came back, it was misfiring. What I would suggest for you to do at this particular point, Kenny, is if you have access to an infrared gun, what you need to do is start the engine, and then with the infrared gun, let it idle, or maybe go on a fast idle, wherever it's going, whatever speed it starts to miss. If it misses at idle, I want you to take a temperature reading with the infrared gun on each exhaust port coming into the exhaust manifold or closest to the cylinder head, so we can identify which is the colder bore, and the bore that is colder will be the one that is misfiring. And at that particular point, you probably have only a few choices. Number one, either the injector is sticking or has an issue inside, or it has a valve train problem. Or the least likely cause would be that it broke a piston ring, which I doubt that it would happen so quickly, and there's no other telltale signs. So I think it's probably more an injector, but it could have broken a valve spring. So if it has a double dampener spring, and this has a single with a dampener. It could have broken the dampener, and the valve is lazy to return. But by going and using the infrared gun, we will at least identify what cylinder it is, and that it shouldn't be too hard to pull off the valve cover if need be. But I would do that first, identify which hole is the coldest, and it'll be substantially colder if it's misfiring, and then you may want to pull that one injector out and look at it, or you may also want to spray some oil around it when it's running before you pull it out and see if it helps the misfire condition, because the seal could be leaking. And the mystery here is that it happened all of a sudden. So usually when it happens all of a sudden, I mean, 9 chances out of 10 something broke, and it very well could have broken a valve spring, or it could have, or the injector pinto could have stuck. And you changed the fuel filter, so I think you changed it because you was misfiring, but you may have to end up pulling that one injector out and bringing it to injector shop and see what's going on. So listen, thank you so much for listening, and I hope that you have a better understanding of why you should use higher quality and, when possible, application-specific factory parts. And I hope that you're able to tune in next week, and just remember that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer. You have a blessed day, and you be well. Take care.